Thanks for tuning into Journey. Everyone is welcome at the table. We are a community being shaped by Jesus, experiencing and practicing humility, curiosity, belonging, and generosity. We hope to be a people who embrace the way of Jesus by listening first, speaking second, loving freely, and giving generously.
So we're going to do our normal thing. We're going to talk about the talking snake this morning. If you have questions, you can text them in. If we don't get to them, Kevin does an amazing job answering them. We also have the Convos with Kevin class after, and then some we hit during the podcast. We also have a time for open Q&R, question and response, because the answers aren't always that great. So there's the text line. We're going to dive in. And if you remember, if you're new to our community, we've been sort of marinating in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And our goal is to make the Bible weird again so that we approach it with curiosity and humility, not just thinking, oh yeah, I know exactly what all of this means. In some cases, we do ahead of time. And in other cases, when we do a deep dive, it's like, oh, this is a little bigger than what I thought it was getting at. So in Genesis 3, verse 1, we come across a talking snake. And, you know, Christians, if you were raised a Christian, this is like, well, yeah, this is just part of the story. But for those of us who were not, like, we believe some really wacky things. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, virgins give birth and people rise from the dead. And of course there's a talking snake on page, you know, 3. Not a problem. And so I want to make that a bit weird again, because I think the snake that is operating in a slightly different level. So go ahead, Stephanie, throw up Genesis 3, verse 1. Now the snake, now the Hebrew word is lakash, was more shrewd. And remember, we covered shrewd. That's actually not a negative thing. That's a positive thing. The serpent was wise. Now the snake, nakash, was more shrewd than any living creature of the field which the Lord God had made. And that could either mean it is a living creature of the field, but just smarter than the rest of them, or it's not a living creature, or it's not one of the living creatures of the field at all. It's different because of its wisdom, and that's the view we're going to take. Snakes in the ancient world, they were symbols of so many things. They were symbols of disorder. So a snake was it's a water animal that doesn't have fins, and it's a land animal that doesn't have legs. And so it's kind of the symbol of disorder, of something that doesn't fit well into the natural order of things. Snakes were symbols of resurrection, because they would shed their skin and they would be reborn. There were symbols of death, obviously, because of their venomous bite. There were also symbols of divination or sorcery, where you would try to sort of divine the future. In fact, the word nakash that is translated snake is also the word that's used for sorcery or divination later in the text, which is so interesting, right? So Deuteronomy 18, when you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you, do not learn to imitate the detestable ways of the nations there. Let no one be found among you who sacrifices their son or daughter in the fire, or who practices divination, nakash, the same word for snake. Or 2 Kings, and there are multiple examples of this, 2 Kings 21. In the two courts of the temple of the Lord, Manasseh built altars to all of the starry hosts. He sacrificed his own son in the fire, practiced divination. Again, there's this word, nakash. So the minute you see the word nakash, you're like, okay, it's a snake, but it's representing something bigger. And that would have just made sense in the ancient world. Snake imagery is all over the place. Another clue to the identity of the snake comes at the end of Genesis 3. Notice, right, we looked at this passage last week. After God drove the humans out, he placed on the east side of the Garden of Eden cherubim, and a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the tree of life. Now, cherubs, I think is how you pronounce it. I've always pictured cherubs as cute little precious moment sort of figurines. You know, they're a little chubby and they're adorable and, you know, they're full of hearts and love and they're great on Valentine's Day. And it's interesting, that's not exactly the way they're presented in the Bible. But in the Bible, they are spiritual beings. And evidently, because God places two of them at the entrance of Eden, spiritual beings were also dwelling with God and the humans in the garden. And cherubs, anytime there's a throne scene, these cherubim are mentioned and described. Sometimes they're called living creatures, but they're described as sort of throne guardians. And I want to give a couple of examples of where they're referenced. So they're called living creatures. They're multi-form. Usually there's some mashup of human and then animal and then winged animal. And they're described differently every time we encounter them. But these beings were evidently a part of the whole Eden scenario, where Eden was the temple space, where God met human space. And there were spiritual beings besides Yahweh walking around in Eden. So let's go to Ezekiel, very famous passage. We're very familiar with it. Not at all. In my 30th year, in the fourth month of the fifth day, while I was among the exiles by the Kabar River, the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. Now, anytime you get visions of God, you're getting throne room visions. And part of throne room visions are these cherubs, these spiritual beings around the throne. So notice how they're described. I looked and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal. And the fire was what looked like four living creatures. That's our cherubim right there. In appearance, their form was human, but each of them had four faces and four wings. I could totally picture that. Their legs were straight, their feet were like those of a calf, and they gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had human hands. So they had wings, and under the wings they had human hands. All four of them had faces and wings, and the wings of one touched the wings of the other. Each one went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved. Their faces looked like this. Each of the four had the face of a human being, and on the right side each had the face of a lion, and on the left side each had the face of an ox. Each also had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. They were like, okay, all right, certainly, this is not a precious moment. Whatever this is, you wouldn't buy it at Hallmark. You know what I'm saying? They each had two wings spreading out upward, each wing covering that of the creature on either side, and each had two other wings covering its body. You're like, oh, okay. Makes perfect sense. So they're this hybrid human-looking slash animal mashup of all kinds of creatures. And we see this kind of mashup in every throne room scene. So in Revelation, which we covered, in the center around the throne were four living creatures. These are the cherubim. And they were covered with eyes in front and back, of course. The first living creature was like a lion. The second was like an ox. The third had a face like a man. And the fourth was like a flying eagle. The same animals that were just referenced in Ezekiel. Here we show up in Revelation. Each of the four living creatures had six wings and was covered with eyes all around, even under its wings. Perfect. So obviously these are symbolic of something, but they're referenced all over the place. So when it says in Genesis, and God put two cherubim to guard the way into Eden, the assumption is that those creatures were around the heaven and earth space that was called Eden, and that they were present among the humans that were walking with God in the garden. Are you with me on this point? Now, Isaiah does something really weird. Weirder. Isaiah, yes, more weirder. Isaiah calls these creatures seraphim, which is an they're here. Yes, they're here. Oh. Yeah, that's why the first thing angels say all throughout the Bible is do not be afraid. That's the first thing they have to say when they show up. They're never like, oh, you know, the humans are terrified of them. So Isaiah does this really weird thing where Isaiah calls them seraphim, Look at this, Isaiah 6. In the year King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and the whole earth is full of his glory." Now, seraphim, this is the only place they're called this. Seraphim is the Hebrew word for venomous snake. So evidently, among the spiritual beings surrounding the throne are snake-like creatures that have wings. That's really weird. Now, let me show you this from different passages. Notice Numbers 21. Nakash is the normal word for snake. Seraph or seraphim is the normal word for venomous snake. Right? So Numbers 21. Yahweh sent snakes, Nakash, and venomous snakes, seraphim, among the people, and they bit the people. Deuteronomy 8. Yahweh led you in the great and terrifying wilderness of the snake, of the venomous snake, seraph. Isaiah 14, do not rejoice, O Philistia, all of you, because the rod that struck you is broken. For from the snake, Nakash, from the snake root, a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying snake, a seraph. Weird. More weirder. Because... So we meet a snake who can talk, all right? Then we meet, at the end of that whole episode, we meet cherubs, and we read about cherubs, and they're like these winged creatures, living creatures that move along or around the throne. They're like throne guardians. And then in Isaiah, they're called seraphim, which is just the word for venomous snake. And you're like, okay, well, that's interesting. Maybe that piece of information explains one of the really weird things God says to the snake in the middle of Genesis. Remember this from last week. Verse 14. So God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and wild animals. You will crawl on your belly and eat dust all the days of your life." Now, how can that be a curse if the snake was already on its belly? It lost its wings. It was cut off from Red Bull. There was the tree of life. It was Red Bull. Cut off. So evidently, I'm just taking the text as it's coming to us. Evidently, this creature had wings and now is cursed to be the lowest of land animals, and it crawls on its belly as opposed to whatever deadly it had done before. Are you with me on this? Now, flying snakes are all over the ancient Near East, not surprisingly. So let's fire up, Stephanie, the flying snake pictures. This is one of the Egyptian snake gods. And remember in Ezekiel when it says that it had legs like a human legs? Here you go. I can't pronounce it. It begins with a W. But that's one of the Egyptian snake gods. Notice it's not crawling on its belly. It's walking. Next. This is color abstracted from many different pieces of ancient sculpture and tombs and so on. But this is another one of the snake gods. Notice, what does it have? It has wings. Next. The middle, it's hard, this is a hard picture to see, but the two beings to the left of the one sitting down, those are coiled snakes that have small wings attached to them. The middle one is another of the Egyptian snake deities. Next. You see that little thing on the Pharaoh's, like the top of his head? That's a coiled serpent called Urea, I think it is. And it's a winged snake. And you would see this all over. Next slide. You'd see it right there. Next. One of the interesting pictures is of the Egyptian room of the gods. And you have these flying serpents just sort of floating around the atmosphere. Right? So it's in the cultural air. So when the original audience would have heard stories about a flying snake that could talk, they actually had a category for this, right? This was not shocking to them. This was a symbol of disorder, a symbol of improper knowledge. That's what divination and sorcery is. And it was a symbol of rebirth. And so you have accounts that totally are at home in the ancient Near Eastern world of multiform creatures that sit around the throne of God. In one account, they're described as seraphim, which is a winged snake. Now, all of this, so there are three bits of evidence. All of this paints a picture that the snake isn't a snake. The snake is a spiritual creature who was gifted with wisdom but chose to use that wisdom to deceive the man and the woman. Are you with me? And thus, later writers will refer back to the serpent imagery using terms like the Satan or the devil. Or in Revelation, we meet this great dragon, which is a winged serpent. Right? So far, so good. It's so weird. All right. Now we're told that this serpent, who was a being of some favor, because remember, it was shrewd or wise, now gets cursed to eat the dust of the ground all the days of its life. Now, eating the dust is like, it's a taunt. It's a way, like, another one bites the dust. You know, very famously was spoken for some of us who are older. Dust was a symbol of victory. So you get, like, in Micah, a taunt over a defeated nation. They will lick dust like a snake, like creatures that crawl on the ground. They will come trembling out of their dens, and they will turn in fear to the Lord God. Or in Isaiah, this is a picture of like the messianic age when God comes and restores things. The wolf and the lamb will feed together, and the lion will eat straw like an ox. The dust, though, will still be the serpent's food. And so you have this image over and over of a being that was favored who's now fallen and cursed to humiliation, right? And as that being is fallen, that being has taken the human project with it. So Genesis 3 is the record not only of the fall of the human beings, but of the fall of this great spiritual being. With me so far? But there is, and this has been true all throughout Genesis, there are these notes of mercy. So the next verse after the curse to the snake is this. I will put enmity between you, serpent, and the woman. Now, enmity is animosity or hostility. And between the serpent's seed or offspring, and her, the woman's seed or offspring. And then we read about a he, one of the woman's seed or offspring, singular, he will crush you, serpent, on the head, and you will strike his heel. Now, the rest of the Bible is the outworking of this right here. So even in, we're talking to the man, the woman, the serpent, they've succumbed. The man and the woman are now imaging the serpent. They've given their authority away to a created being rather than the creator. And what God does is, remember, he doesn't curse the humans. He curses the ground, and then he curses the serpent. And what's the curse of the serpent? Well, it's to live in humiliation, right? That's the dust. But also that there will be conflict between the human project that will result in a singular person, a he, who will come and defeat ultimately the serpent, though the serpent will also strike a blow against the he. Now, obviously, all of us, we go, yeah, that's Jesus. But the original people would have been like, okay, so we're waiting for a he. And then we're going to meet a bunch of he's. We're going to meet Abraham. We're going to meet Isaac. We're going to meet Jacob. right? We're going to meet David. We're going to meet Solomon. And every time there's this, like in the background, there's this haunting, like, is this the he? Is this the he? And then one by one, every single Old Testament hero falls and ends up imaging the serpent. So the Old Testament ends with this promise just dangling out there unfulfilled. Instead of defeating the serpent, all the humans have just imaged the serpent. Now, let's talk about the word seed. And this is such a weird word for us. Seed here is both singular and plural. So I can have a bag of seed, in which case I'm referring to a whole bag of individual seeds, or I can have a seed singular. So seed can function either as a reference to a singular or a reference to a whole group. Are you with me on this? Perfect. It's like the word offspring. You don't say offsprings to make it plural. I can be a singular offspring, or I can refer to a whole group of offspring. So that's the first thing to notice about seed, because we're going to meet seed that is plural, and we're going to meet a singular seed, a he. Seed can also refer to physical descendants. Can I think of any stories in Genesis where there is animosity between the physical descendants of people? Read Genesis. It's the whole story, right? I mean, you've got, like, off the top of my head, you've got Cain and Abel, Joseph and his brothers, Jacob and Esau. In Exodus, you have Ham, who turns into Egypt, and Shem, who turns into the Hebrews. Like, the whole story is the story of physical descendants at war with each other. But there's a third meaning, and this is the meaning we're going to focus on of the word seed. How is this referring to just the seed of the woman, the physical descendants of the woman? But then what would be the physical descendants of the snake? So there's another way that seed is used, and that means in the image of or choosing of. So we're going to encounter people who image the serpent, and we're going to encounter people who image Yahweh. We're going to encounter people who are the offspring of the snake because they, knowingly or not, image the snake. And we're going to meet people who are the image of Yahweh because they image Yahweh. Are you with me on this? This is a very important point, that seed can mean physical descendant, but it can also mean someone in the image of. Or the seed of the woman can be an expression of someone choosing to image Yahweh, and the seed of the snake can be an expression of a human who chooses to image the serpent. Make sense? So, block quote, not many today. As representatives, the snake and the woman embody the fate of their seed, and the fate of their seed is their fate as well. At first, in verse 15, the enmity is said to have been put between the snake and the woman, and between the seed of the snake and the seed of the woman. But the second half of verse 15 states that the seed of the woman, a singular he, will crush the head of the snake. Though the enmity or hostility may lie between the two seeds, the goal of the final crushing blow is not to crush the enemy seed, but rather to crush the snake itself. So this is why Paul will say, our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against... Do you see how big a point that is? Even when we come across people who are imaging the serpent, they're still not the enemy. The enemy is the serpent they're imaging. Are you with me? This turns out to be big. So, the seed of the serpent, those who give in to the serpent's same temptation become his seed. And the seed of the woman, those who resist the serpent's temptation and overcome him. Now, we immediately meet two physical descendants of the seed of the woman, one of whom is going to image Yahweh, and one of whom is going to image the serpent. What are their names? Cain and Abel. Like, immediately. So, Genesis, verse 4. Chapter 4, verse 6. Remember, Cain is plotting to kill his brother. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin, this is the first time we encounter this word, sin is crouching at your door like an animal, and it desires to control you, but you must control it. So this is what it means now that the snake is loose in the world. The man and the woman have been exiled from the garden, and their physical offspring, the seed of the woman, now one of them has a choice whether to image Yahweh by refusing violence or to image the snake by engaging in violence. And we all know what Cain chooses, correct? And here the snake is presented with a new word, sin, crouching at the door of Cain's life. And so we're instantly told, well, these two share a physical lineage, but one of them is the seed of the serpent and one of them is the seed of Yahweh. One of them worships appropriately, one does not. And then the one that didn't murdered the one who did. Are you with me? Now, there is one place, and we have to cover it very briefly, where there is physical seed of the serpent. And that is this awful, beautiful, terrible story in Genesis 6 that causes the flood. So let's talk about the Nephilim, shall we? When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God. Now that phrase is never used of human beings in the Old Testament. Used of human beings in the New Testament, but not once is it used of human beings. It's used of spiritual beings. The sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they took any of them they chose. Now, if you remember, in Genesis 3, there is a woman who saw something that was forbidden and took it. And she was guided by a rogue spiritual being. Now there are spiritual beings who see women and take them. Do you see that? It's Genesis 3 flipped. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal, and the word means corrupt. Their days will be 120 years. Now this is a reference to the coming flood. If you add up the genealogies in 5, you get 120 years, Genesis 5. The Nephilim, which means the giants or the fallen ones. The word, the letters are the same for either word. And this is where we get the idea of the fall. These were the ones who have fallen. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, which is weird. When the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them, they were the heroes of old, men of renown. Now, this is so weird. So what we've got, ladies and gentlemen, is the inverse of Genesis 3. Now the sons of God are seeing and taking, and there are offspring being produced that are giants. And these giants are men of renown, which is a Hebrew way of saying these are people characterized by incredible violence who found violent empires. Okay, the first one we're gonna meet is a guy named Nimrod, unlucky name, who founds the city of Babylon. So one of the Nephilim did this. Now, the reason the flood shows up is to wipe out the Nephilim. That's the reason for the flood. But not all of them die. When the Israelites come to the promised land, there are still giants there. And so one of the reasons why God orders Israel to exterminate certain territories is because those were the places where the Nephilim lived. And in fact, there's one Nephilim. We know the name of the last Nephilim. His name is Goliath. He's 9 feet, 9 inches tall, according to the text. And he's covered, and if you go read the text, it's so interesting. Everything is described in terms of how much bronze he was wearing. And the word for bronze is the same word for snake. So Goliath is covered in snake. Here comes David, a paradigm of the seed of the woman who loves Yahweh with all his heart. And he comes and with the help of Yahweh defeats the snake, the last Nephilim. And then you think, maybe he's the he that's coming. But then what does David do? He sees Bathsheba and he takes her. He becomes like one of the sons of God who fell. So the Old Testament ends with there hasn't been one singular person who has resisted the temptation of the snake. And so when Jesus shows up, what's the first thing that happens? The very first thing that happens, he goes into the wilderness to be tempted by the serpent. And he can image God by creating for himself food and not trusting the Father. He can image the serpent by listening to the serpent's temptations. And what were the temptations? Well, here, just bow down to me and you can have all the power and glory right now. Or make food for yourself. You don't have to be hungry. You don't have to be fully human here. Or test God. He's promised to keep you safe until the appointed time, so go ahead and throw yourself off the temple. All of those were temptations to image the serpent. And so Jesus stands as the anti-Nephilim, the anti-Cain, like the singular he. That's why his obedience is such a big deal in the Bible. Because he's the only one that images Yahweh and refuses always the temptations of the serpent. How cool is that? In the New Testament, notice how this image in Genesis gets played out. Go to Romans 16. Man, I love this stuff. I love it. This is such a weird passage. Paul is listing all of his coworkers, and then he kind of interrupts the flow of his conclusion, and he says, hey, I urge you, brothers and sisters, to watch out for those who cause divisions and put obstacles in your way that are contrary to the teaching you've learned. He's talking to the Roman church is divided into two factions, and they're judging each other like crazy. The whole book of Romans is intended to heal that fracture. And then right at the very end, Paul says, watch out for people who are dividing the church. For such people, oh, you were right, Stephanie, for such people are not serving our Lord, but their own appetites. In other words, they're not imaging God, they're imaging the serpent. By smooth talk and flattery, they deceive the minds of naive people. And you're like, okay, yeah, we gotta be careful for those people. Next slide. Everyone has heard about your obedience, so I rejoice of you, but what I want you to do is be wise about what is good and innocent about what is evil. And then here's the weird verse. The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. And you're like, what? We were just talking about resisting divisive influences in the church. And Paul says, when you do that, God is crushing the serpent using you. Oh, that's interesting. So spiritual warfare evidently is caring about the unity of the church. Okay. Or jump down to John 1. I mean, the significance of this. Now, let's skip that one. I mean, it's great. But we got to wrap. The true light that gives light to everyone who's coming into the world. Everyone was coming into the world, excuse me. He was in the world. This is the Word becoming flesh. And though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize Jesus for who he really was. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who what? He gave the right to become the seed of the woman, the children of God. Notice, children born not of natural descent or of human decision. This means like when a father would dictate to the rest of the household what they would believe. Or a husband's will, but they're literally born of God. And so the whole New Testament sees the two realms, the realm of the serpent and the serpent's seed, and the realm of the woman and the seed who is now Christ, in conflict with each other. But our enemy isn't the seed of the serpent. Our enemy is the serpent himself. And we participate in the crushing of the serpent in the way that we as a community live together. Whoa. Let's talk. Let's take some questions. There it is, Genesis 3, ladies and gentlemen, which ends on such a beautiful note. But notice the disappointment that comes through the rest of the Old Testament. Is this person the singular he? Is this person the singular he? Is this person the singular he? And all alike, the answer is no. So we're literally dying for one to come. Cues. Oh, cues. I was like, cues, I'm cueing. Thank you. All right, quick question, concise, clear, clarifying, quality. I mean, we don't judge that. We don't judge that. If we have to judge the cues, then we have to judge the responses, and I don't want that out there. All right, so yes. Yes.
And then I thought that was so interesting at the end of that slide that was like, watch out for being the husband's will or like what you're taught.
Yeah.
You have to truly make the choice for yourself.
That seems to be the flavor of it, yeah.
Exactly. And then that seems like such a different spin on the choice. Is that repeated elsewhere?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure I understand what aspect of the choice you're referring to there.
For like this watch out for, you know, it's almost like the premise of here, but like ask questions and like make the choice for yourself.
Yes.
Which is such an outsider here. It's such a
right
thing not that many people are told what they have to believe or they fail.
Yeah. I think that in the ancient world, if you were not a wealthy male landowner, you were subject to everyone else's will for you. And what this is saying is when it comes to becoming a child of God, the only will you're subject to is God's will. Does that make sense? That it doesn't matter what the house head of the household is defined or whatever else. Like when you individually say yes to this word coming into the world, you become the seed of the woman that was talking of, that was spoken of in Genesis 3. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it. I feel like it's like a whole another layer of how important it is to make sure that you're making the choice and not just doing what you were told to
totally.
Believe or believing what you were told to believe.
Yeah.
It's like questioning is necessary to make the choice.
Yes, I think that's part of it, absolutely.
Okay.
Yep. You bet, anything else?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so yeah. Hi, Ken.
Okay, so it doesn't seem like an accident that the original audience for Genesis had just come out of Egypt. And
there's
a flying snake on Pharaoh's head. So is there some, like, what's going on there with, like,
oh,
they would have seen something like, oh, yeah, this we're talking
totally.
About Pharaoh. Would they have thought we're talking about
Pharaoh? Absolutely. Absolutely they were talking about Pharaoh. I mean, think about what the plagues were in Exodus. The plagues were not just random, like, okay, I'm Yahweh, and I'm thinking frogs today, you know? And, oh, that didn't work, so let's do some darkness. No, all of those, John Walton makes this point, all of those plagues targeted Egyptian deities. Yahweh even says, I am making war against the gods of Egypt. So when Yahweh controls the frogs, there were the frog god, and all of a sudden, the frog god can't control the frogs, or the Nile god can't control the Nile. And so Yahweh, this is just another way Yahweh is doing two things at once, declaring his supremacy and undercutting all pretenders. And that's why it's interesting. When Moses, what's Moses and Aaron's staff turn into? A snake. And the Egyptians are able to replicate it. Right, that's one of the signs that they were able to duplicate themselves. It's just, I mean, there's the undercurrent of all of this is just amazing.
Just a quick one off the, just a point of clarification off
yes.
the text line.
Point of clarification. One of the cues.
The Hebrew word for bronze is the same as snake. Is that right?
Well, the letters are, yes. So do you know how we can, and we've talked about this before, you can have the same English letters and have it mean two different things, like lead, right? It can be lead or lead. This is what's happening with bronze. Right. And that's why when you read the account, you're reading about the armor that doesn't fit David, which was Saul's armor, doesn't fit, versus the bronze armor, which sort of has snake connotations written all over it. I know, juicy.
That's fun.
I know, that is fun.
About 3 o'clock, Mike.
Is that three? See, three, I thought three was over here. You're feeling more like nine.
About 9 o'clock. Yeah. I'm curious about the introduction of the sons of God in chapter 6 in Genesis and them taking like human women.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Like, when did spiritual beings like that leave the scene? And I guess more importantly, I'm curious how an understanding of spiritual beings and their interaction with humans like should inform my understanding of like my faith today. Like, what role does knowing about this realm and this world play in how I understand God?
Oh, okay. We could spend hours. So in the ancient Near East, it is a customary motif of semi-divine beings having relations with mortal women and producing demigods. So that's in the air. Peter and Jude both reflect the view that these were spiritual beings who violated the boundaries between their sovereignty over the spiritual realm and the human sovereignty over the land. And so I'm fairly confident that's how the earliest folks would have understood this. I'm horrified at whatever implications there might be. We do see in the earliest books of the Old Testament, spiritual beings who appear as humans, right? So Abraham's debating with the sons of God about, you know, and it doesn't seem like he's talking to snakes there. Or multi-headed winged creatures. It seems like he's talking to people in human form. So I don't know. That's the only time where we literally see sort of physical descendants of the snake, and God does everything to stamp those out over and over and over again. As to your second question, I was raised to believe that spiritual warfare consisted of an angel on one shoulder and a devil on my other shoulder, and I was always picking between them. And that I was so important to God's plan that any growth I made was opposed by the enemy. And that could be in the form of blown tires or sickness or whatever. And I'm open to that possibility. We meet people in the Gospels who are sick because of, you know, demonization. But what Paul does with spiritual warfare is so much more profound. First of all, he makes it a corporate endeavor. So the armor of God, you know, when we're battling the enemy, that's written to a church. That's not written to you individually. So the church needs to have a breastplate and shoes and whatever else. So it's not something you just do by yourself, which, of course, as Americans, we think that's what it is. But the second thing is, spiritual warfare, the way Paul understands it, has to do with how you treat people. And so it doesn't make any sense to us, but even that Romans 16 passage, be careful of the people who will divide you. They're imaging the serpent. And the God of peace will crush the serpent under your feet when you do that. So the role of the church in opposing the false teaching of the dividers was a way of crushing the serpent's head. So spiritual warfare has blown up for me from beyond my individual circumstances to how I, as part of a community, treat other members of the community and how we as a community treat people who are not a part of the community. Does that make sense? So that's what this whole strain of thought has done for me. Spiritual warfare is a way of life, not just naming and claiming certain promises when I feel, you know, opposition in my personal life. Does that make sense? So that's why, like, John, first, if you read 1 John, he's saying it over and over and over. If you claim to love God but hate your brother, you're literally a child of the devil and the truth is not in you. You're imaging the serpent when you hate your brother or sister. And so I don't spend a lot of time worrying about who I'm hating. I spend a lot of time in my own personal purity. Did I have my quiet time today? You know, have I avoided sin or whatever? And so verses like that sort of explode my understanding of, okay, why does it matter that I'm treating other people as the Imago Dei? Why does it matter that in a church that where people believe all sorts of different things, we have to fight for unity? You know what I mean? Like, it broadens it for me. So I don't know. I don't know if those are good first steps, but that's where all of that takes me. It's a really great question.
Over at 315.
315!
I'm not on, though. Are we on? There we are.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a clarifying question.
Oh, two of the cues right there.
I guess the first part of it is the word Satan, am I understanding that it's now representing more of a general group of fallen spiritual beings versus just a singular
great
thing?
Question.
And then great how question. Does that relate to the idea of the angel that fell, that I feel like has always been taught that was
yeah.
Satan?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great question. Thank you. And that you embody the cues so well in that. So the Satan, and that's how he's referred to with a like definite article. The Satan is not a name, it's a title. And so I think it is a singular, and it's the snake in the garden. That's how the later writers seem to like use the serpent imagery later, is that one is the one. And so, but remember, seed can be singular or plural. So the Satan has seed, and that seed is other fallen beings, but it's also human beings who choose to image and give into the temptation of the serpent. So I do think the Satan is a singular spiritual being. And then what was the second part of your question? I'm sorry.
The angel that was...
Yes. So Ezekiel uses Eden imagery to describe the fall of a city. Like, and I think it's Ezekiel maybe 38, where I think it's Tyre, where the king of Tyre falls, goes from favor to humiliation, and the analogy is just like a spiritual being in the garden. And so like it's really kind of a confusing, but like the writer is saying to the king, you were with me in Eden. And so I think people rightly see that the motif there in Eden from favor to humiliation was true for that spiritual being, but also could be looked at as a model for like Nebuchadnezzar or other fallen kings. Does that make sense?
Over here, Mike.
Yeah.
Right here.
Yeah. Lucius. Hi, Lucius.
So this is another clarification, and it's really simple.
I never trust that disclaimer
I'm
ever.
Serious. Can you just refresh us on the definition of like the actual word church?
Yeah.
Because we've been talking about church and community so much, but in our culture, church is so loaded. Like, what's the original word
what
used
a softball.
There? What does the original word mean there? And
yeah.
Like, get us back to basics on what we
yeah,
should be
yeah,
thinking
yeah.
of when we say the
I
word
love
church.
That. Totally. So, in the Greek world, you had citizens and non-citizens. If you were a citizen of Rome, there were certain rights and privileges that were accorded you. One of those was membership and voice in something called the ecclesia, which was, if you lived in a city of like 2,000 or 3,000, you would have magistrates and sort of local leaders, but the ecclesia was a place where everyone could speak, and it was made up of citizens. And they would speak on political issues. So it was a political word. So when Paul is roaming around for how to describe a group of people who have allegiance to a different king and citizenship in a different kingdom, that's the word he chooses to use, because it's a place of equality and it's a place of voice, but it's a political entity. In other words, it has its own politics, and those are the politics of Jesus as opposed to the politics of the Roman world.
So it was a town hall.
It was a town hall. It was no stage, no lights, but picture 20 people in your living room, all of them from different social locations, and somebody who literally is a slave down the road saying, hey, I think I have something from the Lord. And the community hearing that and weighing it and testing it together, and then someone saying, I have a psalm. And the community weighing that and testing that. And then at the end of that, we eat a huge meal together. And at the very end of the meal, when there's just the last bit of bread and wine, we take the Lord's Supper together. That outpost, it doesn't matter where it met, it didn't matter what program it engaged in, that outpost was a political outpost of the kingdom called an ecclesia. So as we get into political seasons, you have to understand the Bible is very political. To say Jesus is Lord, that's a political statement. It's not partisan, but it's very political. It has real world implications for us. So thank you for that softball. Could you sit in the 11 and ask the same question? So, brothers and sisters, as we kind of have wrestled through Genesis 1 and now 2 and 3, we're kind of left with not only a sense of lament, which we engaged with last week, that we're now exiled from Eden.